Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, sleep disorders and the tongue's role in sleep. But up front, more than half the money from the federal government meant to help renters and homeowners in Pennsylvania pay their rents and mortgages during the pandemic wasn't distributed. Housing advocates unsuccessfully petitioned the governor and state legislature for months to extend the temporary moratorium on evictions that expired on September 1st. A federal order through the end of the year banned most evictions, stalling what many fear is a future wave of homelessness as it did expire. A recent Spotlight PA report highlighted the issue at a time when many renters and homeowners are worried about keeping a roof over their heads. The journalist who reported that story was Spotlight PA investigative reporter Charlotte Keith. Charlotte Keith joins us on the program. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Charlotte Keith, Pennsylvania renters and homeowners missed out on roughly $108 million of $175 million in federal coronavirus relief. What happened?
So this really all goes back to the end of May, when the state legislature approved a spending plan for these federal funds that Pennsylvania had received from the CARES Act. And $175 million of that money was put towards rent and mortgage relief. And after the law passed, there was this huge rush to create a program that would actually give out the money. But the problem was, major problems with this program, problems that had been written into the law that created it, emerged basically almost immediately after applications were able to be submitted in early July. And the biggest problem was the maximum payment that each applicant for the rental assistance program could receive was capped at $750 a month. And the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency, which was overseeing the program, added this requirement that landlords who accepted that $750 payment kind of act as if it covered the full amount of rent so that they would forgive any money owed beyond that. And as a result, many landlords were reluctant to take part in the program. And unless they were willing to do so, their tenants were not able to get the assistance.
So that was the biggest part. There were other factors as well, and we'll discuss those. But that $750 a month, all right, so let's take a look at that. If you're a landlord who participated in this program, you agree to take $750, and that's it. No more money after that during that month. I mean, that figure, I don't know what the medium rent is here in Pennsylvania, but I guarantee it's not $750. Where do they come up with that figure?
So my understanding is that figure was kind of a compromise. One of the challenges that lawmakers faced in trying to figure out how to distribute this money was to try to make it stretch as far as possible, given the incredibly high demand that there would be. And so the problem, though, is that it was a figure that was set for the whole state. And obviously the average rent, varies greatly across Pennsylvania. And so in some counties, the $750 cap wasn't necessarily a problem. And in other counties, it was a major problem because $750 barely covers, the average rent, let alone someone who might have a higher rent than that. The program was designed to help landlords and tenants because landlords, remember, they are struggling financially too. And so helping tenants pay their rent helps landlords as well. But this cap then became a big problem for landlords. And financially, many landlords said it didn't make sense for them to forgive that amount of excess rent.
So what a landlord had to decide is, okay, do I take $750 knowing that I'm at least going to get $750, or do I not participate with the possibility that I may not get paid at all? Was that a decision that they had to make?
Yeah, I think that's about right. You know, the other factor that played into this was there was a lot of uncertainty as the program was rolling out and, you know, several months in about the state's ban on evictions and what would happen with that. Right before the program launched, the ban was extended through September. And then in a surprise move, once the state's ban expired at the beginning of September, this new federal ban was put in place. But landlords were quite unsure for a lot of that time when they might be able to actually move ahead with evictions. And so I think that uncertainty also played a role.
If you're just tuning in, we're joined by Spotlight PA investigative reporter Charlotte Keith talking about a lot of money, more than half the money that was allocated to stop evictions to help renters and homeowners in Pennsylvania wasn't spent for that purpose. We'll talk about how it will be used here in a few moments. If you have a question or comment, our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Charlotte, when I introduced this, and your story talks about this, that lack of access was another reason for why this money wasn't allocated. Now, you just explained what the biggest problem was, that the $750 that a lot of landlords didn't participate. But there were other factors involved in this as well, and it kind of goes to this lack of access. What do you mean by there was a lack of access, or it was hard to access, I guess is a better way to put it?
Yeah, so part of the other problem was that many tenants struggled to prove that they were eligible for this program. To be able to get the rental assistance, you had to show that either you had become unemployed since March or that you had lost at least 30% of your income. Now, proving that you're unemployed, that was, you know, relatively straightforward. It could take some time, but you know, that's pretty clear. Proving that you've lost at least 30% of your income, for a lot of people, that was more difficult. And some applicants, you know, I think struggled with getting pay stubs from employers who might have been closed or even gone out of business, or, you know, submitting enough information and getting enough documentation to show that they had lost that much of their income. And so you can really see, you know, the disconnect in the final figures for this program between the amount of demand that there was and the amount of people who tried to submit applications or sought help, and the amount of money that was actually paid out. I think there's no question that there was much more demand than there was money available, but many people began applications and then couldn't complete them or didn't complete them. And so that's part of the disconnect that we see in these final numbers.
Who made the rules? Who made the rules for setting this program up?
So primarily it was state lawmakers when they were writing this spending plan over the summer. They put in place, for example, the $750 cap and the eligibility requirements. But then it was up to the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency to kind of interpret those and stand those up into a program. They would say that they were hampered from the beginning by the law that created the program. And the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency had been asking lawmakers really since the summer to make changes so that the program would work better. So there's really no question that you know, lawmakers were aware that there were significant problems with the program, even as early as July and August.
Well, let's go back to July, because there was legislation introduced by Republican State Representative Sue Helm of Dauphin County that would change some of these rules that would make it easier for those who were in danger of possibly being evicted to loosen up these rules somewhat. But the legislature never took it up. What happened?
So for quite some time over the summer, not that much happened. And eventually the bill that you're talking about, Representative Helms' bill, was introduced. And that bill actually passed the House unanimously in October. But then in a surprise move, Republicans who controlled the state Senate did not advance that legislation. And at this point, time was really running out. Because remember, the deadline for the state to spend all of this federal CARES funding is the end of the year. And so the program was set to stop taking applications before that. So even if Representative Helms' bill had passed the Senate, there would have been really only a couple of weeks for those changes to take effect, which, you know, a lot of people said was already going to be pretty tight. And so ultimately what happened was that bill didn't get taken up by the Senate. The governor made some limited changes by asking the agency to administer the program differently and pushing the deadline back a bit. But really, the kinds of changes that housing advocates and the Pennsylvania Housing Finance Agency wanted to be made much, much earlier in the summer weren't even really being seriously considered until the fall.
And just to repeat, just for context's sake, that means that about $108 million out of $175 million that was available through the federal government was unused for this purpose of keeping people in their homes. So the money wasn't, by the way, this money from the federal government, the state has to use it or it will lose it. So the legislature decided that it will go to the Department of Corrections. How is that decision made and what will it be used for?
That's right. So that decision was made as part of the budget deal that happened in November, as part of, you know, figuring out Pennsylvania had done kind of a partial budget deal earlier in the year and then had to finalize the budget for the next 7 months. And one of the reasons for that decision that the money would go to the Department of Corrections was the state was concerned that the money wouldn't be spent by the end of the year. And it also goes to part of the rules about how states can spend their federal CARES funding. They're not allowed to use the money to fill budget holes, which many states would have liked to do because a lot of state budgets, Pennsylvania's included, are suffering as a result of the coronavirus. But the U.S. Treasury said, if you're using the federal funding to cover expenses for employees who are doing public safety or public health work, you can kind of, that's kind of an exception to the rule. And so using the money for payroll expenses for the Department of Corrections allows the state to spend that without having to show, you know, in any additional way that it's being used for coronavirus relief. It's sort of an exception to those rules.
So just looking back to summarize, a program that was meant to help renters and landlords and homeowners to stay in their homes, it was difficult for them to access, and there were some other factors involved, but the state decided to use the money to fill a hole in the Department of Corrections. So, I mean, that pretty much summarizes it, right?
Yes, that's right. And I think what many housing advocates, landlord groups, tenants and landlords find so frustrating about this situation is that there is all this money left over at a time of really unprecedented need. And there is so much demand for this funding. But because of some of those obstacles and difficulties that were not addressed, that money is being used for something else. But there's no question that, you know, that money, there were even concerns, you know, when the program was announced that the $175 million was nowhere near enough. Hmm. So to not even have spent all of that at a time of such great need, I think, you know, a lot of people find that very frustrating.
We have a question from listener Rich, who asks, did other states have a similar issue with the $750 cap? If so, how did they resolve it? Well, $750 was decided here in Pennsylvania, but how did other states handle the situation?
Right. The $750 cap wasn't a federal requirement. Certainly, I think there are examples of other states that have had difficulties standing up programs very, very quickly and distributing large amounts of money very quickly. That's just an administrative challenge. And certainly other states have taken the similar approach that Pennsylvania did to using some of their CARES funding to cover the, you know, payroll expenses. But I don't think that other states necessarily had the same specific issues that Pennsylvania did with their housing programs.
Congress has just passed a $900 billion relief package. Will it provide relief to renters and homeowners?
Yes, that package includes $25 billion for emergency rent relief. But again, I think the question is going to be, how quickly can that money get out the door? And will it be quickly enough to help people who are facing eviction once the federal eviction ban expires?
Spotlight PA investigative reporter Charlotte Keith. Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Spotlight PA is an independent, nonpartisan newsroom powered by the Philadelphia Inquirer in partnership with Penn Live, The Patriot News, Trib Live, Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and WITF Public Media. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, homelessness during the coronavirus pandemic. Millions of Americans find it difficult to sleep or suffer from a sleep disorder. This at a time when many researchers and medical professionals are saying that sleep is an essential ingredient to good health. And we're still learning more about sleep even today. Joining us now is Dr. Richard Schwab. He is the chief of sleep medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Pearl School of Medicine. Dr. Schwab, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Welcome.
If you have a question or comment about sleep, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Schwab, I want to provide some context before we get into some sleep disorders. But one of the things I said in the introduction is that just over the last decade or so, we've heard much more about the importance of sleep and good health. Why is sleep so important for good health?
We don't really understand why that is, but it's clear that basically every mammal sleeps. And if you don't get enough sleep, at least in mice, for instance, in rodents, if you don't get enough sleep, they actually die from sleep deprivation. So it's clearly important. We don't understand whether it's related to the immune system or other factors. It's probably related to the immune system, but obviously getting enough sleep is critical. Independent of that, I mean, we all know that if you're sleep deprived, that's why we drink a lot of coffee, but if we're sleep deprived, you don't function as well at work, there's risk of falling asleep driving, and so sleep is critical, clearly from just a day-to-day sort of everything we do sort of standpoint, but it probably has some also immune effects that are really important, especially with COVID.
And I do want to talk about COVID, but you said that, we really don't understand. I mean, let's face it, humans on this planet, mammals on this planet, thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and we still don't understand quite why sleep is so important. But as I also said, it's the last decade or so, and I'm, rounding that off, that we hear more and more about how sleep is so important and essential to good health. What's happened over that time period that we now realize that sleep is so important?
I just think we have more information. So there's more information about sleep. We can measure sleep. We all have, abilities to measure sleep at home with Fitbit or other sort of wearable devices. So people are more aware of it. And I think, and we're just more aware between electronic medical records and being able to sort of combine sleep and electronic medical records in different, I don't think it's changed. I think we just have more information about it. I think your issue is it's been there all along. I don't think there's really been a change in the last 10 years, but I think we can focus more on it now. We understand it more. We understand circadian rhythm changes in terms of how that affects our daily activity. So I think there's just better ways of understanding how sleep affects our lives is more the issue, not so much that it's changed in the last 10 years.
What is considered a good night's sleep?
So that's a great question. And we don't really know. And most people don't know how much they normally need to sleep. On average, people need 7.5 to 8.5 hours of sleep per night. But it's different for everyone. And for most of us, it's really hard to figure that out. Basically, what you'd have to do is you'd have to go away for 2 weeks and not have any stress, and just the first week, just catch up on your normal amount of sleep and just not even do anything. And then the second week, just basically run your life like you normally would, but not with any alcohol, not with extra exercise, and say, okay, if I go to bed at whatever time and then I wake up on my own, you have a pretty good idea of how much sleep you need. But for the most part, we don't do that. And when you even do go away, you change your activities. You may be drinking more alcohol, which disturbs your sleep, which is a problem. You may be exercising more, but you can figure it out, but it's not easy. In general, however, most people need 7.5 to 8.5 hours of sleep per night.
You use the term catch up on your sleep. So that almost makes it sound like it's a weekly thing or over several days. You actually can catch up on your sleep. If, say, you only get 5 hours one night, you need 10 hours another night. How does that work?
Yeah, you do. You can catch up. We're almost all of us are sleep deprived, right? I think pretty much that's just the norm now in terms of how we live our lives, although maybe it's a little better if people are at home working from home. But we do get sleep deprived and you can catch up. So that's what happens typically on every weekend, right? You go to work for 5 days a week and then you catch up on the weekends, and that helps. If you're chronically sleep deprived, it becomes hard to catch up. But acutely, you can catch up. How much you need is, again, unclear. It's not really obvious. But having the ability to catch up is really important.
You know, I've heard people, and obviously in what you do, I'm sure you've heard many people say this, but I've heard people say, oh, I can get by on 4 or 5 hours sleep a night. Can they?
So there's a few percent of people who probably can. There are people who are short sleepers who that's what they need, 4 to 5 hours. But that's not 99.9% of the people. And they're fooling themselves if they think they are getting by. I mean, you start them out. So subjectively, you can sort of think they're okay. But when you look at objective data for sleepiness, people aren't okay. So you're more likely to fall asleep driving. You're more likely to have to read a paragraph over and over. You're more likely to make mistakes at work. Now, they may be deluding themselves and thinking they're okay, but the data suggests that when you look at objective measures of sleepiness, you start to perform badly. And so as much as people think they're doing well, I think they're fooling themselves.
What keeps people from getting the sleep they need?
So that's another great question. So there's multiple factors. Some of it's related to just the phone and staying up late, and either it's TV or the phone and doing things in bed that they shouldn't be doing in terms of working. Some of it's related to work schedules. Some of it's related to having children or pets that are disturbing your sleep. Some of it's related to noise because you're living next to something that's loud, like a train or airplanes. And then there's stress and anxiety, and COVID has created a huge problem with this, right? I think many of us are anxious about what's going to happen to either themselves or their loved ones. And so there's big issues from an anxiety standpoint, which also disturbs your sleep. So all these things, and I didn't even give alcohol is another one that actually causes more problems. And these are just normal people who don't have a sleep disorder. So if you have a sleep disorder, it's going to compound this. So there's lots of reasons why we don't sleep well.
So some people, what you just described, it's a choice to stay up watching television, to drink alcohol, maybe to drink a caffeinated beverage before going to bed. But those who have a sleep disorder, there isn't much of a choice there. What percentage of people suffer from sleep disorders?
So there's a number of different sleep disorders. So it's hard to do a specific percentage, but I can list them. So the most common sleep disorder is obstructive sleep apnea. And typically those patients will snore and they may have daytime sleepiness. And that's probably anywhere from 10 to 20% of the population has some level of obstructive sleep apnea. So it's very, very common. Independent of obstructive sleep apnea, we worry about insomnia, which may be, 5% of the population, maybe higher now, maybe up to 10%. Then there's other disorders like narcolepsy, where people are really sleepy during the daytime. And then there's periodic limb movement disorder or restless leg syndrome, which is also common, maybe in the order of 3% of the population. And then there's some odd disorders where people sleepwalk or act out their dreams at night. But the most common ones are obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia.
What is sleep apnea?
So obstructive sleep apnea is where you're fine during the daytime, but when you go off to sleep, the structures in your mouth, your upper airway structures like your tongue, your soft palate, which is the thing that hangs down in the back of your throat, or maybe you have enlarged tonsils. So you have these soft tissue structures that are there, and maybe your jaw's a little bit small, something we call retrognathia. And that combination, those anatomical risk factors, when you go to sleep, your airway narrows. Everyone's airway is narrow when you go off to sleep. But if you are anatomically compromised to start with, your airway is going to narrow and you're going to start to snore. So snoring is not normal. Means there's something, your airway's narrow. It doesn't mean you have sleep apnea, but it's a sign of sleep apnea. Pretty much everyone who has sleep apnea snores. And so as your airway gets smaller, first you have snoring, and then as it gets smaller, you actually have something what we call hypopneas, which are partial airway closures. And then you actually completely close your airway, and that's apnea, and that means you're not breathing at all. So obstructive sleep apnea is when your airway narrows and you develop these partial airway closures or complete airway closures. Your oxygen drops when that happens, and that's not good for your heart or your brain. You have an arousal because your body doesn't like that. So you have this, what we call an electroencephalographic arousal, where the patient may not feel like they're waking up, but if you look at their brain waves, they actually are waking up. So your sleep is fragmented all night long. Your oxygen's dropping. You have these repeated episodes of airway closure. So you wake up, you may have slept 8 hours, and you wake up, wow, I didn't feel like I slept at all. So you wake up and you'll still be sleepy. You'll be sleepy during the daytime. So that's what obstructive sleep apnea typically is.
And I mean, you talked about the lack of oxygen and how it could have an impact on other organs in the body. But I mean, overall, sleep apnea can be a very serious condition. In fact, maybe even fatal in some cases, right?
Yeah, it can be. So it's associated with heart attacks, strokes, and high blood pressure. And then there's obviously the daytime sleepiness effects, which can cause you to have a motor vehicle accident. So there's also relationships to atrial fibrillation, other cardiac arrhythmias. So there's a number of different relationships that sleep apnea, number of different adverse consequences that sleep apnea can cause. And it doesn't do this acutely. So sleep apnea is a chronic disease. It happens over time. People typically have sleep apnea many years before it's even treated. So they'll have it for a number of years. And in terms of the mortality, it doesn't seem like it's something that happens at day one, but it's the data suggests that at years 15 to 20. So if you have sleep apnea for a long time and you have significant apnea, about 30% of the people who have significant sleep apnea in 15 or 20 years compared to a matched population that doesn't have sleep apnea will have died. So it is a big deal. It's not a big deal today, but it's a big deal down the line, and we have effective treatments for it. So you can get people better. So there's no reason for someone to actually ever die from obstructive sleep apnea.
I'm going to talk about those treatments in just a moment. We have a question from a listener who wants to know, how much snoring is too much snoring? How should we gauge whether a snore is bad or okay?
So I don't think any snoring is okay. Although if you have it, typically 15% of women, 25% of men are chronic snorers. And then there's another 15 or 20% that are intermittent snorers. So if you're an intermittent snorer, and it's from alcohol, because alcohol makes snoring worse. It actually makes sleep apnea worse. But then it's relatively easy to fix, right? You don't drink as much alcohol. And so then that will solve that problem. But snoring, and again, if you have a cold, for instance, people will often start to snore when they don't snore normally. So I think if there's reasons for it, then it's not such a big deal. But if you're snoring chronically, it's a problem. And even if you're snoring from alcohol, it suggests, well, there's something a little bit wrong with your airway to start with. And so you need to think about that. But we don't have great ways of to answer the caller's question, we don't have great ways of quantifying snoring. So we don't say, well, your snoring is more severe than somebody else's snoring. The only way we quantify it is how much time do you spend snoring on a given night and how loud it is. But a lot of the loudness is subjective. It depends on how close you are to whatever device you're recording from. So we don't have great measures, but if you're snoring, it suggests that you may have sleep apnea, and I would pay attention to other symptoms like daytime sleepiness, or does your bed partner notice you stop breathing at night? Is your sleep fragmented? And if you have those other symptoms, I would be evaluated for obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah, we often, as a society, I don't know, almost joke about it. We know someone is asleep when we hear them snoring, but basically what you're saying is that that is a symptom of something a little bit more serious. From what I understand, sleep apnea is most common in people who are overweight. Why?
Yeah, so there's a clear, the primary risk factor for sleep apnea is obesity. And so if you look for the first 10 risk factors for sleep apnea, the first 8 would be related to obesity. And then there'd be other things like your jaw being small, or again, back. But obesity increases the tissue, the structures in your mouth. So most people don't know this, but there's a lot of fat in your tongue. It turns out that even in a normal, someone who doesn't have sleep apnea, who's heavy, there's about 25% of their tongue has fat in it. Now, you'd argue, you might ask, why is that? Why is there any fat in the tongue? I mean, we eat, we breathe, we talk. So why is there any fat there? And we don't really understand the why to that. But it turns out there's a lot of fat in the tongue. And in patients with sleep apnea, instead of 25 to 28% of their tongue's fat, it's more like 33 or 34% of their tongue is fat. So one of the, so we don't totally understand the relationship of obesity to sleep apnea, but some of the publications that I've written suggest that tongue fat may be a key driver of that. So that as you get heavy, you deposit more fat in your tongue. And because of that, your airway gets smaller because the fat increases the size of your tongue, making your airway smaller, putting your increased risk for sleep apnea.
Your
and
research.
In fact, we've actually shown in a, good, sorry.
No, you finished what you were going to say.
I was just going to say, we published a second paper where the first paper just looked at baseline of patients' apneics and controls, and we showed that there was more fat in the tongue in the patients with sleep apnea than the normal subjects. And then we did a second study where we looked at what was the effect of weight loss. So as you lose weight, sleep apnea gets better. And what we found was that when you lose weight, you lose actually fat in your tongue. And then factor that was most associated with the improvement in the patient's sleep apnea was actually reductions in tongue fat. So we think it's a potential modifiable risk factor for sleep apnea, especially by losing weight.
This research that you did and these articles that you've authored did get a lot of attention. I know that, for example, the Philadelphia Inquirer, I saw the story in the Philadelphia Inquirer in the headline. It said fat tongue. I don't know whether that's what you refer to it as or not, but, when you're talking about excess fat on the tongue, you just mentioned that you have to lose weight overall. I guess what a lot of people were picturing is that there was some way that you could actually narrow it down to losing weight on your tongue. That's not the case.
Not yet. I mean, I think that's an interesting research possibility. Is there ways of removing fat in your tongue? And then that would help sleep apnea. But the only way we know how to do it right now is with overall weight loss. I don't know, for instance, you could argue, well, maybe certain diets matter. We don't know that. I mean, for instance, if you were on a low-fat diet, would that reduce the amount of fat in your tongue and then help your sleep apnea versus a high-fat diet, again, but maybe the same amount of calories? We just don't know. We don't know much about tongue fat, but it potentially is you're going to learn more about it over the next 5 or so years. We will see that there are potentially, other ways to modify tongue fat, which, again, potentially would improve sleep apnea.
So I guess the bottom line for those who are thinking, oh, I'm just going to lose weight on my tongue. There's no exercise regimen to lose weight on your tongue. It is a whole body experience, something that you have to work on overall, correct?
Well, I think that's correct. There are studies out there that have shown that if you do upper airway exercises and even play instruments like the didgeridoo from Australia, that you can improve people, patient sleep apnea. So if you, if you spend time, for instance, pushing your tongue to the roof of your mouth and you do that consistently throughout the day, or again, you play an instrument, your apnea gets better. We have no idea if that's affecting tongue fat. Those kind of studies haven't been done. But there are studies that if you just look at overall sleep apnea, that upper airway exercises does help your apnea. It doesn't make it totally go away, but it improves it. So there is a link there. We just haven't studied it enough to know if it's related to tongue fat.
You realize, of course, the thousands of people who've just heard that their tongues are moving to the roof of their mouth right now.
Well, that won't be a bad thing. And it's interesting, you know, one of the things you could argue is as a being on the radio talking all day long, we don't know this, but it actually may be good for yourself in terms of being able to talk all day. You actually may be moving your tongue more, exercising your tongue more, and that may be a good thing.
Well, I don't know whether my wife wants me to talk more or not, but you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up later this week on Smart Talk, the great divide between urban and rural Pennsylvania. Joining us for this segment of the program is Dr. Richard Schwab. He's the chief of sleep medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. We're talking about sleep. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Once again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We have a few questions from listeners, Dr. Schwab. Let's see. We have William ask, I fall asleep almost every night for 30 minutes or more late night in front of the TV. Then I drag myself to bed and often sleep restlessly. Should I try to avoid my involuntary 30-minute naps?
Probably, yes. Napping... although typically people post-lunch get sleepy, and so there's obviously cultures that sort of propagate or encourage napping post-lunch time in the middle of the afternoon. But in general, if you're going to take naps during the daytime, it's going to make it may make it harder for you to fall asleep at night. So I would encourage most people not to take naps. On the other hand, to be fair, if you're sleepy and you're driving and that's a problem, it is better to take a nap and to recover than to drive sleepy. But if you're not driving and you're not putting yourself at any risk, it's better to not take a nap.
But don't naps, now he was talking specifically about a nap just before bedtime, but midday naps, for example, don't they help with what you were discussing earlier, catching up on your sleep?
They do, but if you get enough, so it gets back to getting enough sleep at night, right? So if you get enough sleep at night, you shouldn't need to take a nap during the daytime unless you have a sleep disorder. I mean, there's no, if you're getting enough sleep, you shouldn't have to nap. Now, again, that gets to the problem is how much sleep do you need? But if you're not, if you're sleeping through the night and you're sleeping the next day, and again, you don't have a sleep disorder, you're probably not getting enough sleep. To take naps right before bed, yes, that's going to cause a problem. I mean, if you take a nap right before you fall asleep, you may have, you may not be able to fall asleep so easily. On the other hand, if you're really napping before you're falling asleep, then maybe you should just get ready for bed and go to sleep at that point in time, rather than taking a half an hour nap and getting up and doing other things again. It makes more sense to just go to bed for the entire night.
I want to get back to sleep apnea for just a moment. You mentioned treatments. What treatments are there for sleep apnea?
So the most common treatment is something called CPAP, which is it's CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure. And it's basically a mask that fits over your nose or your nose and your mouth, and it pushes air through the back of your throat. So it's basically acting as a pneumatic splint to open up your airway. It's not adding oxygen, it just adds air. So when you have sleep apnea, your airway narrows and gets small. What CPAP does is it stents it open. So your airway remains open, your oxygen doesn't drop, Your sleep isn't fragmented. You don't have any of the apneas. You don't develop daytime sleepiness. It's perfectly safe, but it can be challenging for people to use and sometimes uncomfortable. The newer CPAP machines are smart, though. They track how many hours you use it, how many days you use it, if it's working or not, if there's mass leaks. The new masks are more comfortable than they've ever been. And so for many patients, if they can get through the initial sort of, oh, I have to wear a mask concept, because you do have to wear this potentially the rest of your life unless you lose weight or something else happens. But I have many patients who just, they swear by CPAP, and they will, in fact, if they go away and they miss a part, they sort of freak out and get concerned. So once you get used to it, it becomes just natural for them, and they sleep so much better, independent of the fact that they help prevent their heart attacks, their strokes, their high blood pressure, or improves any of those conditions if they already have it, and they're much less sleepy during the daytime, so they can function normally. So CPAP is clearly the number one treatment. Independent of CPAP, some people only have sleep apnea on their side, on their back and not their side. So we use what we call position therapy to keep them off their back. That's a different treatment. We do recommend weight loss and often weight loss surgery in patients who are heavy with a BMI over 35 or 40. And then there's oral appliances, which are appliances that fit in your mouth to pull your lower jaw forward. So the base of your tongue, the part of your tongue you can't feel, inserts into your jaw. So if you move your jaw forward, it pulls the tongue forward and opens up the airway. So those are all the sort of the non-invasive type treatments, although weight loss surgery is a little bit invasive. And then there's surgery for sleep apnea. Most of the surgeries don't work very well, at least the ones that are ablative, outside of tonsillectomy. Tonsillectomy or adenoidectomy work very well in children and can work well in adults if you have big tonsils or a big adenoid. But for the most part, the conventional ablative surgeries for sleep apnea don't work very well. However, there's a new treatment called, and many of you may have heard this because it's been advertised, called Inspire. And so what that is basically a pacemaker for your tongue. It's hypoglossal nerve stimulation. So it is surgery, but it's relatively easy. And it's basically a pacemaker that has a lead that goes to the hypoglossal nerve, which is a nerve that innervates your tongue, and you turn it on with a remote control at night, and it pushes your tongue towards your lips, so it moves your tongue forward. What I like about this surgery, it's reversible. So the nice part is that you can take it, if you don't like it or it's not working, you can remove it. You'll be left with scars, but you won't be left any worse for wear. Your tongue will still act just it would have regardless of not having it. So unlike other surgeries where you have to move tissues and can't move them back, or ablative, which means you take them out and you're never coming back, hypoglossal nerve stimulation is fairly effective. It doesn't work in everyone. It's about 75% effective, and it's reversible. Now, it's very expensive, so you need to make sure your insurance covers it, and there's certain specific criteria in terms of your body mass index and other things that have to happen, but I do like that surgical treatment option.
But getting back to CPAP, which is the most common treatment, you were talking about how it has improved recently, but compliance is still the biggest issue there, isn't it? That many people will say, oh, I don't want to wear this mask. I don't want to do this. It's uncomfortable. I can't get used to it. Isn't compliance the biggest problem?
It is a big problem. And even we do a pretty good job at Penn. I think probably 75% of our patients use CPAP consistently. It still means 25% don't. So there's a large number of people who can't use it. If you go to other sleep centers or patients or doctors are maybe not paying quite as much attention to the details about what type of mask and that kind of thing, the adherence might be on the order of 60% or 50%. Now, to be fair, if you look at other adherences to medications, for instance, high blood pressure medications, arthritis medications, it's about the same. You know, you look really across the board, it's 50, 60, 70% of patients are actually using the medications consistently. So it's probably not worse with CPAP, but there are ways of making it better. So if you acclimate during the daytime, different masks, we can track use now so we know if it's working or not, how many times people are using it. And so I think we can do a lot more in terms of understanding the why if somebody's not using it. And the part I like about it is it's perfectly safe. It's safer than taking a medication. It's safer than driving to work. Basically, CPAP can do nothing to hurt you, and it does a lot to help you. So I think if people understand that and get beyond the fact that, oh, yeah, I have to wear a mask and it's uncomfortable. Like I said, once you get used to it, patients stay on it, and they like it. Now, that, again, that in our hands, I would say 75% of patients tolerate CPAP well. It still means 25% aren't. So you do need to have other options, but I would encourage all your listeners to try CPAP first.
In fact, we have a specific question, or I should say a question about a specific instance here from a listener. It says, how is apnea treated in persons with insomnia due to PTSD and due to childhood abuse? The CPAP machines restricting head and body movements can trigger PTSD, cause a panic attack, and make sleep impossible. Have you come across issues like that?
Yeah, I mean, it is complicated because I think you need to treat the PTSD and insomnia with what we call cognitive behavioral therapy and some counseling. And your listener's correct. I mean, there are people who get very anxious with a mask on them. So that some of the masks are very different now. So some just fit inside your nose and there's what we call nasal inserts. And they're not putting much over your face. So it's not as, you don't feel so claustrophobic. But even with that, some patients still get anxious with it. And what we try to do is sort of have them sort of acclimate to it. So first, when you're awake, you just wear the mask, just not even attached to the machine. Just get used to wearing a mask while you're watching TV, while you're reading the newspaper or working on the computer. So you get used to something on your face. And then what we try to get them to do is to put the machine on awake. Again, just get used to it breathing, just with it on over time. And once you acclimate to that, then you can potentially sleep with it. That takes some time. It can take a month or two to do what I just said. But if you do acclimate, you can probably solve that problem. But that listener, it is challenging.
Another listener question, how does our sleep needs change as we age?
Yeah, so as an infant, you need a lot of sleep. So infants might sleep 14 to 16 hours a day. Even adolescents need probably 9 or 10 hours of sleep. And most of them aren't getting it because they're getting up early to go to school. And then as we age, you lose what we call delta sleep. And that's stage 3 sleep. And so the two sleep stages that are really important are REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep, dreaming sleep, or delta sleep, which is stage 3 sleep. It's what we call deep slow wave sleep. So for instance, if you normally sleep 8 hours a night, but whenever, and I do an experiment on you and I knock you out of delta and REM sleep, every time you go into it, I give you a tone so you don't have any delta or REM sleep. You'll wake up the next morning and feel really sleepy, like you didn't get a good night's sleep. On the other hand, let's say I only give you 6 hours of sleep. Again, normally you get 8, but I magically increase your REM and delta sleep, which we don't really have a way of doing. But if I were able to do that, and you would wake up after that 6 hours of sleep, again, 2 hours less than you normally get, and feel like $1 million because you had increased REM and delta. So those two stages of sleep really matter. We do lose delta sleep as we get older. It's just sort of a natural phenomenon. But if we could figure out ways of increasing delta and REM sleep, that would be really good.
We only have a minute or so left, and Dr. Schwab, it's been very interesting. Someone wants, and I guess this is what we all want to know, the best sleep aids or the best way to get to sleep. And this listener actually mentions counting sheep. It works for some people, but what's your advice?
Yeah, so there's no right answer to this. First of all, taking sleeping pills in general is a terrible idea. Second, alcohol is a terrible idea. It's causes sleep fragmentation. Don't ever use Benadryl, any of these over-the-counter medications to help you sleep, all bad. Exercise is a really good idea. So if you exercise in general, whatever that is, that's gonna help you sleep. So I would encourage everybody to exercise on a regular basis. Keeping your sleep schedule the same, also super helpful. So if you always go to bed at the same time, get up at the same time, even on the weekends, the more that you can get your body in tune to going to bed and waking up at the same time, it's really helpful. You can count sleep. Other people sort of tap a finger. There's other ways you can do it, but there's no right answer to any of this. But I would say generally, stay away from alcohol, sleep normally, as much as you can, keep your schedule really regular, and exercise as much as you can.
Dr. Richard Schwab is the chief of sleep medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Dr. Schwab, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Everybody have a great day. Happy New Year to everybody.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.